Professor Gigi Foster, you're a professor of economics at the University of Sydney, and you have a focus on the economic impact on what's going on, what's been happening here as far as the anti-corona measures are concerned. Is that correct?
Yes, except that I'm a professor at the University of New South Wales, which is located in Sydney, but okay. It's a different institution. Okay. So yes, I'm an economist, and I was listening very intently to what Rocco had to say about his dismay at the fact that his profession had essentially been missing in action during the start of this COVID period. And that was very much my observation as well amongst my colleagues. Very few people spoke out from the economics profession. And if at any point in history you'd think that they would, it would be at moments at which people's ability to engage in free enterprise and the sorts of, you know, normal consumption and production activities that keep an economy working were being threatened by a government. But that didn't happen. It was myself in March 2020, a couple of isolated people at certain think tanks here, the Institute for Public Affairs, Gideon Rosner there, Adam Crichton at The Australian, who's an economics correspondent. He also started to question. And a couple of sort of older people, really, people in their 70s and 80s who'd been around the block and perhaps had a bit more historical context in which to place what was happening. But not only were people in my profession largely silent, many of them were, in fact, apologists for what was going on. And there was a letter written by a few of them, influential economists, and then signed by 200, I think sometimes under duress, although I don't have proof of that, which essentially was an open letter to the prime minister in April 2020, saying that there were no trade-offs involved and that the only choice was to lock down the economy in order not to essentially have a health disaster, which would kill the economy anyway. And I thought that this was a travesty and just an absolute idiocy. Unfortunately, there were some small responses to that. There was one contribution by Henry Ergas and Jonathan Pincus, two economists, that said, return to sender, economist letter is rubbish, or something like this. But there were just very, very few of us who were prepared to go into the public space and argue for this. And early on, I thought that the hysteria would pass. By April or May, I just was not expecting this long-term phenomenon. And I believe that a lot of our perplexed, our puzzlement at what's happened here is because we really haven't seen in most of our lifetimes a phenomenon like this. And one of the things I'm able to do, because I research power and loyalty and networks and kind of big concepts in economics, is understand that social scientific phenomenon we're seeing in the context that it should be seen, which is, what are people like? What can they do over history? What have we seen? And I think what we're seeing now is a crowd dynamic. It is a herd mentality and the development of a crowd very similar to what we've seen in the past. We saw it in the U.S. Prohibition period. We saw it in the witch hunts in the U.S., my home country, although I'm a naturalized Australian now. We even saw it in 1930s Germany. In fact, that's probably one of the best examples. And what happens in a crowd is that every member of the crowd becomes enraptured and focused obsessively on one thing. In the case of the COVID crowds, it is this idea that COVID is the danger. COVID is a pestilence. We must crush it. And that kind of obsessive focus for so many people in a crowd, it gives them a sense of belonging. And it also gives them a vitriol, which they spit at anyone who dares to question the truth and the morality emanating from the crowd. And so people like me, and you know, there were maybe a handful of us, were absolutely pilloried when we went on national television and wrote things in the national newspapers and, you know, spoke on national radio saying the lockdowns were maybe costly and we should have a cost-benefit analysis done. And that was the main thing I was calling for as an economist, because most large policy decisions we expect these days, just by the norms of the profession, do have a cost-benefit analysis behind them. But the government did not release one. Month upon month upon month, it did not release one. And finally, in August 2020, I was invited to give testimony at the Victorian Public Accounts and Estimates Committee. This is in Melbourne. And I basically said what I think, which is that lockdowns have massive costs that have not been considered when deciding upon these policies. And they haven't been balanced against the supposed benefits. And because the parliaments had not come up with anything, I wrote up a 4-page draft cost-benefit analysis myself in, you know, I don't know, 15 hours or something. And I said, this is how you do it. Right? This is what you need to do. And here are the categories of costs. One of the stumbling blocks in my profession has been during this period that people seem unable to think clearly clearly about how to calculate the various different costs, right? And this is a major problem, not just for economists, but as well for many other scientists and lawyers. And very coincidentally, a colleague of mine just in 2019 had brought to market a new currency called the WellBe, the well-being year, which enables the capture of all things which matter to people's life satisfaction. It's essentially based on the question, overall, how satisfied are you with your life? Which is a question in many social surveys around the world. And it's answered on a 1 to 10 or 0 to 10 scale of satisfaction. And basically, one WellBe is a year of a time of one unit increment on that 0 to 10 scale. So if you say that you're only a 6 on that scale instead of a 7, then that shows that you have suffered a decrement in your life satisfaction. Now, that's a wonderful currency for capturing one of the main areas of cost during this lockdown period, which is the social isolation and the mental stress, the loneliness, all of the things we know are prompting crazy increases in our calls to Lifeline and the other kinds of mental health support services here in Australia. And that has been a cost that is directly related to the policies and has been completely ignored in all of the policymaking, as far as I can tell. And of course, a lot of people, not economists, will think, well, why would an economist care about that? But of course, economics does aim to maximize human well-being. And so we do care about human suffering, and we care about the thriving of people as much as we care about their length of life and their, you know, their health in general. So that was one area of cost, but there are so many others. The disruption to schooling that we've seen will be with those children for generations. The amount by which we have exploded the national debt during this period, it's gone up by an untold quantity. We spent $200 billion at least on JobKeeper, which was our first program to supplement people's incomes when they couldn't earn them. And that means that in future, we're going to be able to spend less on every line item that the government usually spends on, including education, infrastructure, healthcare, R&D, anything you name. And in developed countries, that expenditure creates life. It creates longer life, better life. And so we are shooting ourselves in the foot. We've hit a complete own goal. And the population have gone along with it in Australia, I think partly because we've been lucky to be an island nation and to have blocked our international borders so early that we hardly had any COVID in here at all. And during the lockdowns, it looked like we were doing well. So people confuse correlation for causation, as we say. They figured, oh, well, look, we've done well, therefore it must be lockdowns. And that ignited the obsession of the crowd. And now we're still just in that. And I'm not quite as optimistic as my colleagues. I would like to believe that people are really, escaping from this crowd dynamic. But I honestly think that what it will take is a bit more suffering, less government support, so that people really feel the economic damage themselves. And honestly, the rest of the world opening up and Australians looking overseas and realizing that, gee, you know, we don't have that freedom anymore. Why don't we? I'm mad. I'm now going to push back against the politicians. So I speak about all of these things and my feelings about like how we can understand this period in a new book, actually, coming out in about, I think it'll be about 5 weeks now, The Great COVID Panic. So, it's been my way of trying to make sense of this whole period because it's been incredibly frustrating and despairing. And I hope that the book will bring some solace to people who are questioning.
Excellent. I'll translate this. Also Professor Gigi Foster ist nicht wirklich Professorin an der Sydney University, das heißt, obwohl die in Sydney ist, sondern die heißt University of New South Wales. Sie sagt, das ist nicht nur bei den Juristen so gewesen, dass die, so, sie hat so formuliert, missing in action waren, also im Krieg verschollen waren und nicht mehr zu hören gewesen sind, sondern es ist auch bei ihren Kollegen, bei den Wirtschaftsprofessoren, bei den Ökonomen so gewesen, dass sich so gut wie gar keiner gemeldet hat, um irgendwas zu sagen. Nur deutlich ältere Leute, die einfach ein bisschen Erfahrung haben, hat sie gesagt, die haben sich zu Wort gemeldet. Viele andere haben alles, was da passiert ist, mit den Anti-Covid-Maßnahmen entschuldigt. Und sie sagt, sie kann es zwar nicht beweisen, aber bei sehr vielen von denen hat sie die Überzeugung, dass die schwer unter Druck gesetzt wurden, damit sie sich derart entschuldigend äußern. Es sei eine Travestie aus ihrer Sicht, dass die Regierung allen Ernstes behauptet, das ist nicht so schlimm, wenn die Wirtschaft zerstört wird, denn durch Covid würde sie sowieso zerstört werden. Es gab also nur ganz wenige, zwei Professoren hat sie eben genannt, die sich dagegen ausgesprochen haben. Sie beobachtet hier so ein bisschen auch aus der psychologischen Warte, eine Massendynamik, eine crowd dynamic. By the way, this crowd dynamic is precisely what a professor of psychology from the University of Ghent, I think, in Brussels, in great detail told us about. This is not just like hypnosis, like mass hypnosis. This is mass hypnosis, and it works on 30% of the population. However, 40% of the population is sort of standing on the sidelines, watching what's going on, and they cannot really be reached and intimidated by this kind of hypnosis. And then there's the 20 to 30% of the population who are immune, because they immediately begin to ask questions. So we do have a good chance to turn this thing around. Also, das ist eine Massendynamik, die sie sieht, ungefähr so wie es auch die Hexenjagden natürlich hier in Europa, aber auch in den USA gab es die ja gewesen sind, aber auch das, was in Nazi-Deutschland damals zu erkennen gewesen ist. Es ist hier so eine Art Obsession betreffend Covid. Nichts anderes wird mehr gesehen. Das ist allerdings alles auf diese Furchtkampagne zurückzuführen. Das sieht sie auch so. Es ist vor allem überhaupt gar keine Politik, keine politische Linie erkennbar. Denn das haben wir ja auch aus dem berühmten Fehlalarmpapier gelernt. Das ist sogar ein Papier aus dem Innenministerium von einem ausgewiesenen, hochkarätigen Bevölkerungsschützer. Aber diese Überlegungen sind in Australien bei uns ja auch nicht. Das ist ja sofort totgeschwiegen worden. Auch wenn gleich niemand widersprochen hat. Aber diese Überlegungen werden in Australien überhaupt nicht angestellt. Diese Cost-Benefit-Analysis, die man braucht, also Kosten-Risiko-Analyse, die hat sie gemacht. Sie selbst hat eine angestellt und hat versucht, der Öffentlichkeit und der Regierung klarzumachen, dass die Schäden durch die Maßnahmen weit, weit schwerwiegender sind als alles, was das Virus selbst, wenn es das überhaupt gibt, jemals anrichten könnte. Es gibt da eine neue Währung sozusagen, das ist ein Wellbe oder das ist der Wellbe. Das scheint mir eine Abkürzung für Wohlergehen zu sein. Und damit kann man insbesondere auch messen, wie zufrieden eine Bevölkerung ist. Die misst nämlich auch Faktoren wie soziale Isolation, Einsamkeit, der mentale Gesundheitszustand der Bevölkerung. Das alles wird vollständig ignoriert von der Regierung. Aber wenn die sowieso keinen Plan hat, dann wundert einen das natürlich nicht. Sie sagt, es ist wichtig, dass man sich um das Wohlergehen der Menschen kümmert, dass das eine zentrale Währung sein muss in auch einer solchen Pandemie oder Scheinpandemie. Wenn das nicht passiert, dann passiert eben ein gewaltiges Werk der Zerstörung, weil man einfach die Risiken solcher Maßnahmen überhaupt nicht im Blick hat. Zum Beispiel die Zerstörung des Schulsystems, was sie beobachtet. 200 Milliarden werden für Arbeitslosenhilfen ausgegeben. Jetzt wegen dieser Maßnahmen, das ist Geld, was später fehlen wird, wenn es überhaupt jemals da gewesen ist, will ich dazu ergänzen, wenn das nicht mal nur gedrucktes Geld ist. Sogenannten sozialen Ausgaben, die hält sie für besonders wichtig, weil das ja auch für den sozialen Zusammenhalt sorgt. Wenn das allerdings jetzt alles verfeuert wird, dann wird es in naher Zukunft fehlen. Die Lockdowns haben, weil sie falsch rübergebracht wurden, die Illusion erweckt, als würde es aufgrund der Lockdowns in Australien allen eigentlich ganz gut gehen. Sie sagt, das ist völlig falsch. Da wird wieder mal Korrelation und Kausalität miteinander verwechselt. Sie sagt, sie ist nicht ganz so optimistisch wie ihr Vorredner. Sie sagt, wir werden schon eine Umkehr hinkriegen, aber wir werden wahrscheinlich noch einen massiven Zuwachs an Leid sehen müssen, bevor die Leute wirklich wach werden und auf die Straße gehen, massenhaft auf die Straße gehen. Vor allem brauchen wir gute Beispiele aus dem Rest der Welt. Sie schreibt dazu ein Buch, was jetzt gerade rauskommen wird, The Great COVID Panic, wo sie sich sozusagen das alles, was sie hier auch in ganz kurzer Fassung berichtet hat, vom Leib geschrieben hat. Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much. I'm not as pessimistic as you are. I think, but that's, you know, that's me.
Well, I've been looking at the poll figures, and our politicians have gotten reelected on massive landslides after having done lockdowns. So that for me is a bit chilling. But I do think that there's hope for the future, and we put some suggestions in that book about what we can do to try to improve our institutions going forward, to try to make ourselves more immune against a similar thing happening in the future.
Yeah.